Thank you again to the Kapitanskis for sponsoring this morning's shiur. In honor of Hushleim of Glenn's mother, Chana Baschava. And thank you for everyone who has jumped in to help us by sponsoring the shiurim, please God, for the coming Sunday mornings. Habalein Latova. Great to see you all. I hope you're doing well. We begin this morning with a letter, which, if you are on the list, hopefully you received it by email. If you did not, please send me an email, let me know. I'm going to share it right now on the screen and read it out. Don't worry if you are just in your pajamas and your screen is off and you are not watching either, you're just listening. Says the letter this morning, L'chvod Rosh HaMemshala, Adoni Rosh HaMemshala. Here we go. Ki Yehudi, as a Jew, Shomer Mitzvos, who observes Mitzvos, Mechayeves osi hakaras halacha hahalacha hapsuka b'chol hanogea ledine ishos v'dine giur. As a Jew who is mitzvah observant, this observance, this commitment to halacha requires that all matters related to ishos, meaning marriage, divorce, V'dine Giyur, and the laws of conversion. V'ashela, and the question, Shehu amda al yedei kvod Rosh HaMemshala, the question that you, Mr. Rosh HaMemshala Beit Gurion, asked, is in this realm. L'da'ati, next line, al sofik o'shela chadasha misa'uras ben yonam e'la tzrichim l'da'ati, it must be this question comes, lios muvayim, to be brought, Bifnei Bezdin, before a court, Harabaniim, of Torah scholars, who are musmochim lifsok ulahachria, to paskin and to decide. And therefore, this issue that the state, Hachlatas HaMemshala, on July 15, 1958, is out of its bounds. It's the government getting involved in religious affairs. And I am totally opposed to this. Because, he starts off his letter, I am a Yehudi Shomer Mitzvos. A Yehudi Shomer Mitzvos. Who is this author who writes, who introduces himself as a Yehudi Shomer Mitzvos? So of all the people, right, of the 50 people that Ben-Gurion reaches out to in this book, in this series of letters in Mi Yehudi, this man introduces himself as Yehudi Shomer Mitzvos. He's not a rabbi in the conventional sense. He's a scholar. An Israeli scholar who happens to be a rabbi, but is a Yehudi Shomer Mitzvos, is someone who is connected to and committed to mitzvah observance and a Torah lifestyle. And his name, as he signs his letter, we will get to it, the rest of the letter a little bit later, Ephraim Aleph, Ephraim Elimelech Urbach. And so this morning, my goal is to introduce all of you to this man, who some of you may know, but many of you may not know. Because this man, he challenges us, he encourages us, and he inspires us to think about our Judaism in a very interesting way that maybe we haven't thought about. As he introduces himself first and foremost as Yehudi Shomer Mitzvos. Where is this man from? Who is he? Why is his letter significant? Why is Ben Gurion asking him? Ephraim Elimelech Urbach was born in Vostovek. I apologize for the mispronunciation. Vostovek in Poland in 1912. His family was from the Sachetshaver Chassidim. Some of you are familiar with the Sachetshaver Chassidim as the Shemi Shmuel Rav Shmuel Bornstein, or his father, the Avnei Nezer, the Egle Tal Rav Avram Bornstein. Great giants of the world of Chassidus in Poland. So this little boy, Ephraim Elimelech, he goes to a traditional Torah education, but then his parents send him to a gymnasium to receive a general education. And at the age of 18, he leaves Poland and he travels to Breslau, where he attends the rabbinical seminary. Now, Breslau is actually today in modern day Poland, but at that time it was in Germany. And it was kind of like a progressive place of Jewish learning. On the one hand, it was quasi-yeshiva. On the other hand, it wasn't a traditional yeshiva. It wasn't necessarily from the tradition of Eastern European Lomdei Torah. It was actually founded by somebody who was associated with the conservative movement. And he went there to study Semitic languages, philosophy, and history. And because he had a traditional Torah background of Gemara and a tremendous talent, he became very popular with his teachers, and he became a tremendously accomplished student. In 1933, with the rise of the Nazi Party, he left Germany, he left Breslau, and he went for a period of time to Rome. When he was in Rome, he studied under Professor Cossutto, he visited the Vatican Library, and he started writing and exchanging letters with great academics of the time. And he earned a fame as an accomplished young researcher and scholar, especially among other scholars who are living in Yerushalayim. He completes his doctorate in 1935. How old is he now? 23 years old. And he goes back to the Breslau Seminary to become a lecturer. He's a professor. He's 23 years old. He stays there until 1938. In the end, this is crazy. Imagine. In late 1938, he decides he's going to leave Germany right before Sukkot. What's going to happen, by the way, in November of 1938, shortly after Sukkot? Kristallnacht. But he gets out before Sukkot. He travels back to Vastavek, where he spends Sukkot with his family on his way to the Hebrew University in Yerushalayim, where he received a research fellowship. And because of that, he got a certificate to get into Palestine. Only 2,000 such certificates were issued. And because of that, he left Europe, arrives in Israel, and he settles in to start a new life. Bintayim, you know what happens. Rachmana Litzlan. On Kristallnacht, the Breslau Seminary is closed, and within a short few years, his entire family is murdered in the Shoah. Nobody's left. That was the last time he saw them, was on Sukkot. And later in his life, we're not going to focus on this so much today, but later in his life, Urbach spent a tremendous amount of time and energy researching, writing, and publishing on the world of Europe before the war. That was his family. Those were his rabbeim, his teachers, his influence, his whole world. That whole part of his life was completely destroyed, of course, once he made it to Israel. Interestingly, he is encouraged by a man who we met recently, Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog, to join the British Army in World War II as a chaplain, which he does. And he accompanies the British Army in Tunisia, Sicily, Libya. He traveled with Montgomery's 8th Army throughout North Africa. And when he was in these places, he sought out scholars and ancient books and rare manuscripts and all kinds of things. He wrote a letter in 1943, quote, "I have found ancient headstones, manuscripts of liturgical poems by local poets, various documents. If I have time, I would like to write a comprehensive article on Libyan Jewry, past and present." He was discharged from the British Army in 1946, and by then he was married to a woman by the name of Chana Pinchauer. And they settled in Yerushalayim. He was a principal of a school, after which he received several positions in the Ministry of Education in this new Hakamas HaMedina, in the new school, in the new state of Israel. In 1953, he becomes a lecturer in the Talmud department in Hebrew U. And for many years, he devoted himself, as we'll talk about in a little bit, to Talmudic research. In 1969, he was the head of the International Well, first he was promoted to a full professor. Then he becomes a member of the Academy of the Hebrew Language and the Council of Higher Education. In 1969, he was the head of the International Association of Jewish Studies. You're talking about a man who was literally at the top of academic Jewish studies in the world. From 1980 to 1986, he served as the chair of the Jewish Studies Institute at the Hebrew University and as president of the Israel Academy of Sciences. I'm going to share his picture on the screen right now. Let me see if you can tell me if you could see it. Hold on. This picture that you're going to see is also, you'll see also some documents at the bottom. You see it now? You see it there? A small picture? If you're watching, you see this is the page of the biography for Ephraim Elimelech Orbach, if you want to look it up on your own, from the National Library of Israel. Look on the bottom here. There are some interesting documents. This is the certificate of the fellowship that he received from Hebrew U in 1935. If you could see it on the screen there, that's what enabled him to get to Israel. This is his smicha. He also received smicha from the seminary in Breslau, 1935. And this is the invitation to serve as the rabbi of Tripoli in Libya when he was in North Africa. The level of accomplishment of this man is really astounding. And there he is. You see his picture right there. Like a warm smile with his kippah. Wherever he went, he wore his yarmulke. Little mustache there. And he is the face of the world of Jewish studies. You know, there is, you know, it's hard to underestimate the significance of this man. He died in 1991, but he was literally mamish at the top of the world of accomplishments in academic Jewish studies. And because of him, you know, scores of students studied under him and were inspired by him to follow this work and this world of academic Jewish studies. So he published, ready for this, over 300 scholarly essays. 300. He published several works that were literally groundbreaking. So the first work that he published in 1939 was an unprecedented work, which was a critical annotated edition of the Arugas Habosim. So this is a collection of piyutim, medieval Ashkenazi liturgical piyutim. And he went line by line to explain them and to understand the syntax and the language and the style. This is just unprecedented work. And it was groundbreaking. And then, probably the most famous work, excuse me, by Orbach is this two-volume, which was originally published in the 50s, but then it was republished again in 1984. This is the, I don't know, I shouldn't say the only, the only authoritative initial work that spawned many, many, many later works called Balei HaTosfos. Orbach wrote this masterpiece analyzing the historical background, the personalities, the context and the literary output of the major participants in the Tosafist movement. So you remember the if you look in a standard Gemara, the Gemara has the middle section, which is edited in the 5th century. On the inside of the book, you have the commentary of Rashi, and then on the outside, you have a collection of glosses by rabbinic luminaries starting in the 12th century, going into the 14th century, living in, let's say, Troyes, Dampierre, Ramereau. These are small villages not far from Paris. Sens, Rashmi Shans, these are a school. They're referred to as the school of the Tosfos, and they have an outsized influence on the study of Gemara, on the shaping of Halacha, especially in our community for Ashkenazi Jews. For those of us who are Sephardic joining us, so you also have something to say about this, but it's not as authoritative. The Baalei HaTosfos, they shape much of our practice. They had a very specific style of learning. So let me share it with you this way. And I was introduced to this whole idea with my own opportunity to study about academic Jewish studies in a class with the great professor, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, when I was in YU. And this class changed my life. It changed the way I understand just Gemara, what people are doing when the Chachamim, when the Rishonim are commenting. If imagine the following mashal, which can help understand what Tosfos is doing and why Urbach opening up the world of the Tosfos to subsequent scholars. His book, when it came out in the 50s, it was a revolution. So it was attacked in certain ways, and then it was supported, and it spawned other scholars to write dozens and dozens of articles. And then he revised it, and he agreed with some of the criticism, and he rejected some of the criticism. It created a whole understanding of this movement of the Baalei HaTosfos. Who were they? What did they mean? What was their creative literary output? How do they shape our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So here's the mashal. Imagine, you know, as many of you know, I live right around the corner. I'm seeing some on this screen. I live in Skokie. So I live on Arcadia. And not too long ago, the village of Skokie decided that they were going to repave our street. Some of us on this this group remember when your street was repaved, what a loch and cup. It was such a headache. It was a disaster. And this was shortly after we moved from Sleeping Bear. Shout out to the Sleeping Bear Chever there. So we had two street pavings in the span of like 3 years. There are two, you can argue, there are two people. There are more than two, but let's focus on two people who are responsible for paving the street. So there's one guy, that's the burly, sweaty, you know, gesunte guy, the shtickel bulvan, you know, he's in the truck, he's wearing a hard hat, he's got a vest, he's sweating, he's got the cup of coffee, and he's actually driving that enormous piece of machinery that has the flattening thing, the giant roller, you know what I'm saying, to make sure that the street is smooth. That's the one guy. If you want to ask who paves our street, so there's the actual road paver, that the giant guy in the tractor, right? In the roller. But then there's another guy, maybe he's a little scrawny, doesn't know how to operate any machinery. He sits in the village office on Oakton, and he looks at a big map. And on the big map are all the streets. So he has Church and Dempster and Main and Crawford and all the streets and the little street alach ours, even in Timber Ridge, and little streets, and they're all on a map, and he looks at them and he thinks, has to figure out, well, if I pave this street, what happens to the next street? And what happens to the water main that's going over here? And what about the flow of traffic that's coming off of I-94 on Dempster? Because all these things have to fit together. Okay? So now, when you look at a piece of the Gemara is the explanation, the exposition, the development of the Torah Sheba'al Peh based on the Mishnayos, and you have a comment in one Gemara. So Lahavdil Elef Alfei Havdalos, Rashi, you know what Rashi's job is? He says, I'm going to make this Gemara so smooth. You know, now when you drive down Arcadia, it's mamish smooth. I see someone here driving on Samoset, so smooth, right? It's blacktop, it's great. You can go roller skating, rollerblading down the block. You're not going to hit any potholes. You're not going to hit any cracks. You won't fall and break your nose. It's super smooth. That's Rashi. Rashi's job is that the Gemara should read so smooth. And that's why he's there. I see some of our chaverim here. A particular chaverim made, one of our chaverim made a siyum on Shas a few years ago. Right? Those who have been through lots of Gemara, if you learn some Rashi and some Tosfos, you know Rashi, he's your best friend. You can't operate without Rashi. You would constantly be falling and breaking your nose. So Rashi makes sure that this ride is going to be very smooth. That's Rashi's job. Great. But that's not the only issue. We want to make sure that it's not just a smooth ride right here. Somebody needs to figure out, wait a second, well, if I pave this street, what happens to the other streets? And what's going to happen when they meet? And what about the flow, the water main, when I'm disrupting it? That is the job of Tosfos. Tosfos is not one person. Tosfos is a school. Many rabbis, starting with the grandchildren of Rashi and their students and their disciples, they say, wait a second, Rashi, I'm very glad that you smoothed out right here this Gemara. This Gemara is super smooth. Great. Thank you. But what about the other Gemara? What about the Gemara that appears in a different tractate, a different Masechta? Well, how do you square those? So Tosfos introduces what we call the dialectical method. Tosfos says, well, now, by having to resolve these two Gemaras, you have to sometimes come up with innovative answers. You have to make different ukimtas. You have to explain the circumstances. Maybe this case is talking about this, and that case is talking about that. And that spawns a tremendous amount of halakha creativity and insight and understanding. This Gemara says this halacha about Kriya Shema. Well, that halacha is contradicted by another Gemara somewhere else. Tosfos views all of Gemara as one integrated corpus, and therefore you have to answer and understand each piece as it relates to each other, not just independent. And this is the Tosfos world, and this is what Urbach opened up to us with this volume. So he goes through the original, you know, the founding Tosfos, let's say Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbeinu Yaakov, who introduces this methodology. And then his students, the Ri, Rabbeinu Yitzchak, many of these, and Rashi Mishantz, many of these figures, you are going to come across them in different ways in your learning. Sometimes they appear in davening, a lot of times in halacha. But these figures are central to our Yiddishkeit, especially as Ashkenazim. So Urbach's book is like, it takes the world by storm, and everybody's talking about it and criticizing it and arguing on it and back and forth. And this is not the only works. Then he writes a work analyzing all of Chazal's approach to different aspects of Hashkafa. You can actually get this book in Hebrew and in English. I think, I'm not sure if the Bali HaTosfos is accessible in English. We have to check that. But his book on the sages and their understanding of principles of Jewish faith, our perspectives on different Hashkafic issues, that I know is available in English. And then hundreds and hundreds of articles. So I have to give a special shout out in preparing for this presentation and thinking about this. So, you know, what do I know about academic Jewish studies, and what do I know about Urbach? So I had the opportunity to engage fascinating articles, many interesting articles. Some of them are on... There's a great website that you can get for free called JSTOR. You can access articles for free on this. You can't download them, but you can read them online. So there's an article about Urbach by Avram Grossman, who is another very important scholar, kind of like a Talmud Chaver of Urbach. There are several articles of Urbach that you can get through JSTOR and through some other websites. And I made a few phone calls to some people who really know something about this topic. I was so grateful to thank and to get some insight and some articles from Dr. David Shaivitz, our very own local professor who is an expert in medieval Jewish studies. And so he knows a whole lot about Urbach and about this world. So he shared with me a couple of articles. And I also spoke to Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig, a student of Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, who has his doctorate in this area. I had a chance to connect with Rabbi Meir Twersky, whose father, the late Professor Isidore Twersky, was a great expert in Jewish scholarship, in addition to being Chassidish Rebbe, the Talmud Rebbe, for those who know him and remember him from Boston. So all of this interesting introduction brings us to appreciate this man who, when he starts his letter, he says, I'm a Yehudi Shomer Mitzvos. I'm a Jew who comes from Europe, who comes from a halachic tradition, who comes to this question of children of intermarriage all these issues of this religion and state, I come to it with a perspective of a traditional Jew, but not the average traditional Jew, not just a Jew who accepts things as they were because they were. I'm a Jew who is also a scholar, and that's why you're asking me. You're asking me because I'm one of the greatest minds and most accomplished scholars at Hebrew University in Israel at that time in 1958. That's why you're asking me, Mr. Ben-Gurion. So that's what I'm going to apply to this idea. Uhrbach was relentless in the pursuit of truth. That's what academic work is about. It's, you know, it's complicated, and as we'll talk about a little bit more in a few minutes, especially as it relates to religious life, it's complicated. And of course, sometimes there's bias and there's politics, but the pursuit of Uhrbach in all of his studies and all of his teachings was about understanding the facts. Of course, understanding them in a context and all of that, but what does logic tell us? What does the truth tell us? What does the research tell us? So because of that, it's interesting that the second half of the letter that he writes back to Ben-Gurion, someone wrote in a question here, what was his relationship with Rav Kook? Well, remember, Rav Kook dies in 1935, and that was before Uhrbach ever got to Israel. Uhrbach didn't get to Israel until 1939. So he never met Rav Kook. He was friends. We mentioned Rav Herzog. He was close with Rav Herzog. Part of the reason I wanted to talk about Uhrbach this week was because last week we spoke about Shai Agnon. 2 weeks ago we spoke about Shai Agnon. He was friends with Agnon. I think this was like, it seems like this was a chevra. At that time, there was a chevra of these people. They came from Europe. They were brilliant scholars, and they talked to each other, right? They were like international, brilliant men. So they interacted with each other. So it's interesting to me on this point about thinking about truth and logic is that the second part of the article, of the letter that he writes back to Ben-Gurion, I'll read now in the English translation. 1 second. Somebody writes in, JSTOR requires a subscription to through your library. Very little is free to the public. I thought so, but you can actually get 100 articles that you can get your own, that you can get your own subscription without a library. If you need help from a library, Dr. Shaivitz is always very generous for me getting me things that I can't get. I can get through YU. If you need an article on JSTOR that you search and you find you can't get it, let me know. I'll be happy to find someone who can get it for you. But there are actually, especially, I think it's because of the pandemic, there are 100 free articles that you can get on JSTOR without a problem. You don't need a library access. Anyway, so Uhrbach says, he says, first of all, as we said before, he thinks that it's wrong to mix the memshala, the state, into a question that is needs to be determined by halacha. Now, his understanding of halacha or his perspective on Torah learning might be different than others. And it's interesting that in 1966, he tried to start a new movement, an orthodox movement, but with more of an academic perspective based on what he had studied in Breslau. And after 10 years, it didn't really materialize. But he still has that strong fealty to halacha, and therefore it doesn't belong in the realm of the state. In addition, he says, let's think about this logically. What's going to be the fate? I'm reading now from the English translation. What will be the fate of a young man who is registered as a Jew on the basis of his quote-unquote parents' request only, and then when he wants to marry a girl unquestionably Jewish, finds that he is only a Jew by virtue of registration? This young man, after all, the duly constituted religious authorities cannot give way to this registration. This young man registered as a Jew will suddenly discover that he is not a Jew and will have to undergo a proper conversion to Judaism. And then he says, what's going to happen to the Jews in the diaspora? And then the last point, which he writes in the letter, we're not going to do the entire letter because it's too long for now, but you have it in your email for those who have it. If you don't have it, feel free to email me, rbrand@torahchicago.org. I'll send you the letter. Last interesting point he has here in the letter. I view as baseless the justification of this step in the name of, quote, freedom of conscience and religion. Meaning, you are saying in the letter, Ben-Gurion says, we want to give people the choice And because the Medina is committed to freedom of conscience and religion as part of the Megillat HaTzma'ut, we want to give people a choice. A principle guaranteed by Israel's Declaration of Independence and in the fundamental law. After all, says Orbach, that doesn't make any sense here. We are not discussing coercion of parents who are partners in a mixed marriage to register their children as Jews. I assume there must be cases where the Christian mother insists that her child be a Christian. I am certain that in those cases, nobody forces her to act differently. The question concerns those parents who want to register their children as Jews. Nobody can demand, in the name of freedom of conscience and religions, that the parents are the ones to decide the manner of registration. Even the government's declaration states that, quote, the religion or nationality of an adult be recorded as Jew if he declares in good faith that he is a Jew and is not a member of another religion. The addition of the phrase "is not a member of another religion" is instructive. It shows that even those who proclaim the separation of nationality from religion will admit an existing relationship between Jewish nationality and the Jewish religion, even if it's negative. It seems to me to register children born of mixed marriages as Jews on the basis of parental request would bring certain harm and questionable good. Some would justify it as a temporary expedient caused by emergency condition, yet it contains the seeds of ruin for generations to come. Even from a national point of view, we can only register the children of mixed marriages in accordance with the clearly established Jewish law. With great respect and best wishes, Ephraim E. Orbach. Let's look at the logic. Let's look at the truth. Let's look at the practicalities. Let's look at tradition. Let's look at halacha. So now, I'd like to take the few minutes that we remain, take a deep breath and be like, wow, what an incredible individual. What a life story. What a life work. And what does it mean for us? How do we realize and how do we engage and understand this whole world that Orbach represents? The world of academic Jewish studies, the world of academic Talmud study, the world of academic halacha, understanding halacha from an academic perspective. This volume, amazing work called HaHalacha, which is published toward the end of Orbach's life. It's in a series of books called Yad LaTalmud. It was published under Orbach's aegis. You see from the front, HaMa'areches, who is in this editorial board, Professor Orbach, Professor Moshe David Har, which, by the way, there is a beautiful appreciation online, which I could send you. There's a beautiful article, a tribute to Orbach by Professor Har, Professor Zussman, Professor Toshma. These people are like the titans. These are the Hall of Fame experts in academic Jewish studies in the world in the 20th century. So this volume is all about halacha. It's the basics and the understandings, the principles and the historical development that Orbach writes through the period of Chazal about halachic institutions. So this is dear to us. This is our whole life. This is what guides us. This is our path, halacha. So on the one hand, we explore halacha, we embrace halacha, and we understand it through a traditional religious lens, through a masorah. What about the perspective of, I guess you would call it Wissenschaft, or the perspective of scientific inquiry? What if you were to subject the Gemara or the Rishonim or the Mishnayos to a literary analysis? And so this became a huge controversy in Europe in the 19th century. There is a legend. There is an important article on this, which I put. You can get to a link to in Layer House for Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Lichtenstein's relationship with the world of academic study. There is a legend that when Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Rav Aaron told the story that when he left Poland to study in Berlin, in the University of Berlin. On his way to the train, Rav Lichtenstein, Zichat Tzadik Levracha, said, his mother half ran to the train, and just as it was departing, said, just don't study Wissenschaft der Judentums. Don't study Wissenschaft. There was a great suspicion of academic study of Jewish studies, of academic Jewish learning. And so it's a complicated relationship. So why is it complicated? Well, because there are not necessarily the same goals or the same set of assumptions in these two realms. They come up with sometimes contradictions. What happens, you know, there is an important article by Urbach that I have here I could send you. It's called Bakoshas Ha'emes Kechova Datis, The Pursuit of Truth as a Religious Imperative. What happens when you have a conflict between the historical record of a particular text versus the text that we have in front of us? Now, it's important to be aware of these things, to know the facts in many respects, even in a halachic context. One second. Sorry, somebody is unmuted. All right, fix that. Sorry about that. So these questions, it's a really interesting world, the question of pursuing historical truth and a fealty to the Masorah, the traditional interpretation, the observance of halacha as we have. So what happens when there is a conflict? You know, we think of halacha not just as a dry and abstract set of legal theories. We understand halacha as kihim chayinu va'orech yameinu. It's our whole approach to connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on a day-to-day level. And we understand that the Ribbono Shel Olam has involvement, Elokim nitza ba'adasel. There is an element of hashkacha. There is a guiding providential hand, that it can't just be by accident that certain developments of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu occurred over the centuries. What's our orientation? So it's a really interesting conversation, and I would encourage you, if you're interested in this, to think about, to reach out and to think about the different scholars and the different approaches that are out there. And it's also important to understand that there isn't just one monolithic academic Jewish studies. There are a lot of different parts of this. How to study the Mishnayos, how to study Gemara, the approaches to Rishonim. Different people have different attitudes. And it's also, I would say, important to think about a nuanced way of appreciating the relationship, the tension, but also the positive contributions between these two fields. At the end of this article on Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein and academic Talmud study, Rabbi Lichtenstein talks about how while there are rifts and there are tensions between these two worlds, on the other hand, the encounter between the academy and the yeshiva potentially could help realize something better for both. And this is something that I've understood in talking to Rabbi Rosenzweig Shlita, Rabbi Twersky Shlita, my Rabbeim, the approach that I've understood and appreciated, that historical contributions, the academic Jewish studies, can contribute a ton, not just to our ability to learn the sacred texts, but even to our understanding and our Yiras Shamayim. To understand who the Balei HaTosfos were, the milieu in which they lived, what they meant, that they were actual living people, that can contribute to the way that we connect with our learning. I could tell you that just that one class with Dr. Soloveitchik, which is the introduction to the Rishonim, I was in the Israeli Graduate School of Jewish Education, but they allowed me for one semester to take a class in the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies. That was the most important class I've ever taken in the history of my education. It changed my world to understand who these chachamim are and how they interact with each other and why it is that an opinion of Tosfos is going to be quoted here and not there. I'm going to show you a map. If we were in person, I would put this up on the wall, but we're not going to have time. You could just see it as a skira right now. This is a map that's put together in an atlas called Eitz Chaim. Each of these dots on this map represents a rabbi in the Chachmei HaMasorah? Who was whose student? Who was whose teacher? Where did they interact? Were they were in France? And this goes on for hundreds of years. And the level of influence, understanding the history of the Rishonim, gives you a great insight into who's being quoted and why they're being quoted and why certain ideas appear in particular context. It could also sometimes be helpful in understanding the pshat, the basic primary interpretation of a text, of why a certain Mishnah is in a certain order. The idea of utilizing kisveyad of manuscripts. So that is, it's incredible to think about how many Rambams that were difficult, and yet they have been resolved by understanding the variant texts that now are understood, they're at our fingertips by the Frankel Rambam, which is a critical edition of the Rambam, or so many other editions. So understanding Kisveyad, a lot of interesting developments, and some of these are controversial, have to do with understanding who wrote which texts. That there are sections of the Gemara, which is noted by the Rishonim, there are sections of the Gemara that were actually not written by the Amoraim. The Amoraim, that's the period of Torah sages, the great spiritual giants. We can't really even fathom their level. So between the 3rd century and the 5th century, well, there are little pieces of the Gemara here and there that are actually amended and introduced into the text of the Gemara. Well, how do we relate to those? So if you look, there's a lot of actually discussion on this in the Sridi Eish, who after I was preparing this talk, I was like, you know what, we should do the Sridi Eish's letter next week. I'm going to have to figure out how to present that. I'll send it out to you far in advance because it's very long. But Bli Neder, I'm going to send it out to you long in advance, earlier in the week. The Sridi Eish, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, was on the one hand from a truly traditional Eastern European Gaonist background, but he also was in Berlin in this Avira of academic studies. So in the 4th volume of the Tshuvas of the Sridi Eish, he deals with summaries. He goes through the different places in Shas where there are sections of the Talmud that come from later Savoroim, they're called, the generation of scholars after the time of close the Gemara. There's a question here on the chat, but I can't understand what the question is. So if they want to rewrite it, feel free to do that. So all of these are interesting and important contributions, and the importance of intellectual honesty and understanding the development. Like, if it's important also, like if we teach children, do you know that this Sefer Torah is the exact same letters as the Sefer Torah that was given to Moshe Rabbeinu? It's not true. And when they find out that it's not true, they might have a crisis of faith. It's important to tell them that there are actually a few places in the Sefer Torah, that is in the Shul, that are not the same as Moshe Rabbeinu. There are a few vavs that are different. And maybe there's a difference in the spelling of the word psuadaka, depending on which Shul you're in. But you ask yourself, okay, do we undermine our emuna by acknowledging that difference? Or do we not undermine our emuna? Do we understand that the, I don't know, 300 and some thousand letters are exactly the same and there are 7 missing ones? And how do we relate to Kri and Ksiv and all these things? So being able to have an intellectual honesty and answer these questions and relate to them the same way that we shouldn't be afraid of biblical criticism. That was part of, we spoke about it from Rav Herzog. This is a big part of the university, the rabbinical seminary in Berlin, and all the Chachamim who are in Germany who are combating that. Because we have, as a tradition, as a community, we have great answers. So to say we're going to ignore the academic side of Jewish studies and put our head in the sand and not realize that there are questions, well, there are people who are going to ask those questions. We have to have answers for them. But at the same time, the attitude and the nature of that kind of inquiry is also very significant. How do people in the, if you're going to use an academic approach to the Gemara, how do they relate to what we consider Kisvei HaKodesh, even though not, the Gemara is not legally Kisvei HaKodesh, but we have a reverence, we have a love, an admiration of an appreciation for this. This is the spiritual underpinnings of all of life. As opposed to viewing this as an imperfect historical text whose authors were simply people in a historical context, right? That is a very different attitude. It's also a question of, is this a replacement? Does this academic study supplant the traditional understanding, the Masorah of learning, of the Havayas of Abai and Rava? You know, these are important questions. If you're supplanting your learning, then is that really Talmud Torah? As opposed to, we have a traditional approach that is reverential, that is understanding, and that is enhanced. So then, ma tovu ma naim. The problem, Rabbi Twersky wrote to me in one email, is, quote, when people confuse helpful historical perspectives with substantive understanding. His father, Professor Isidore Twersky, he told me, was all about understanding the development of ideas in their historical context. So it's about the substance. It's about when, quote, they approach their study irreverently and lower the sublime to their own pedestrian level, end quote. Rav Lichtenstein deals with this to some extent in an article in an article which is published in this volume called Leaves of Faith, The World of Jewish Learning. So in the beginning, he has a chapter which is from an earlier, it's from an article that he published called The Conceptual Approach to Torah Learning, The Method and Its Prospects. So in here, he has a discussion relating to some of the issues raised by the issue of academic Talmud study. And he talks about the importance, the value of, you know, girsaos, of variant texts and other things, and the controversy of Wissenschaft community. But he also, in this context, talks about the importance of the Chachmei HaMasorah, and that the sensitivity to the reverence that we have for the Chachmei HaMasorah needs to be emphasized and understood, and how the Rambam places this at the center of our understanding of the transmission of the Torah Shebaal Peh. These are not just people. They are people. They are human beings, no question, but they're also Chachmei HaMasorah, and how the emphasis on the way that we understood the role of these Chachmei HaMasorah is very significant. And the pedestal, no question, the pedestal, not because people are infallible, but because the nature of the value of that Chachmei HaMasorah has in our understanding of our learning. So it brings up lots of interesting questions sometimes in halacha. So for example, Nicole, this week we're learning Hilchos Shabbos. There's a Magen Avraham who quotes Ramban. Well, did the Magen Avraham ever have that Ramban? What he quotes in the Ramban, maybe it's consistent with what the Ramban writes in the comments that he has on the Rif, which are a little bit ambiguous, but what he writes in the Chidushim, but the Magen Avraham maybe didn't have that Chidushim. So how do we understand that Magen Avraham? It comes back to what Rabbi Twersky pointed out as the substantive ideas. And we need to figure out, well, what did the Achronim say about this idea? Whether the idea was actually the Ramban's idea or not. It's going to matter, because they are the Chachmei HaMasorah, they are the arbiters of Halacha. It's going to matter how they encounter the ideas, not so much the historical context. But to understand the historical context certainly makes it a richer and more well-balanced, and sometimes even informs how it's going to be concluded. So I think what I take away from this, and the personality of Urbach and what he contributes to our lives, is to realize that the world of academic Jewish studies is not something which is, it's rejected wholesale, it's kfira, it's treif, it's something that we need to stay away from. It's something that we need to appreciate its contributions into, and to be open to the questions and the challenges, while we can stay firmly rooted in our traditional approach. And to remember that whenever we start our letters, it always begins, Ani Yehudi Shomer Mitzvos. That's where Urbach starts. I am a Jew who has a fealty to Halacha, to the Masorah, to the Ribbono Shel Olam, to the Chachmei HaMasorah. And that's our attitude, and that shapes how we view everything in the world, including academic Jewish studies, including our search for historical truth. It's all shaped through our spiritual lens. It means that sometimes there are tensions, there are questions, but that's also okay.